Hey, welcome to the Morning Mic Check. I'm Pat Brown here with Mike Metzger. Mike and I have known each other for a while now. I first met him around 2010, and he's become one of the key mentors in my life. Over the years, we've had countless conversations, and in almost every one, I've walked away having discovered something new. Mike has this unique ability where he can reframe a conversation, and you begin to discover a deeper reality around you. It's a bit like Alice tumbling down the rabbit hole. I'm releasing these conversations as an invitation to follow me as I go down that rabbit hole. Well, as always, good morning, Mike. How are you this morning?
Good morning, Pat.
we're going to continue our discussion here on Meadows, and we talked through kind of broadly last week. We mentioned, I guess, a couple different meadows that you can go through in life. The first one, your 20s, the meadow to burn the candle at both ends. The 30s is kind of where you mentioned thumbprint. That's where you sort through and actually you figure out, and to ascend to that, you sort of work through what are you uniquely gifted at. And then your 40s is the meadows of the legacy, figuring out what's going to live beyond you. And then the 50s, approaching limits. You mentioned how death, in a good way, just becomes real, and you start to realize that you have limits. And then lastly, the 60s was a strategic allocation of resources. So given all of those, I'd like to zoom in on the 20s, which is sort of, I guess, a meadow you kind of find yourself in, right? It's not necessarily you ascend to that. You just sort of find yourself in that meadow. Is that correct?
If you make it through your teens.
Well, what I thought was interesting, I've talked to a couple different people, and I found this almost this restlessness coming from them. And it made me think of a conversation I had with you years ago. I remember very distinctly sitting in your kitchen, and it was shortly after you had first told me about the 20s being the time to burn the candle at both ends. And I took that to heart and was doing a lot. And I remember sitting in your kitchen and saying, Mike, I feel overwhelmed. I've got so much going on. I'm spinning so many plates here. What advice do you have? And in classical Mike Metzger fashion, you looked at me and said, so what does it feel like to burn the candle at both ends? And I said something back like, well, I think it feels like this. And you said, exactly. And it was sort of this moment that I realized, oh, this feeling is correct. This is what this period of life feels like. And it was encouraging that, one, I think I realized hard is not bad. And sometimes we confuse those. But the other thing I've noticed is in talking to other guys, there's actually sometimes the opposite restlessness. And that is a sense that I'm missing something right now. And sometimes that's filling life with other things that are just not productive. And so it's almost like for them, they're actually not doing enough. And I don't know, that may be a poor way to phrase that. Another way I've put that, if the 30s is the time where you ask yourself, what am I doing right now that I ought not to be doing? The 20s is then the time to ask yourself, what ought I be doing now that I'm not currently doing? Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, it's a nice summary too. And we don't want listeners to think there's not a Meadows of the 70s and everybody dies at the end of the 60s. But we just don't know because we're not that old yet. At least I'm not. Yeah, that's pretty close. I was listening, and I think that the way we wander through these meadows obviously it's different for each person. I'm not sure in our 20s if we're well enough formed to be considering what we ought to be doing as much as follow your gut, follow your instincts, unless there's some crazy stuff you can do. But a friend of mine and I were joking that it seems increasingly fewer and fewer college freshmen are really prepared to be thinking about what they ought to be studying. But that's a really expensive way to burn through some money to discover you don't know what you're doing. Maybe a gap year before college would be a good idea. But a gap year is, there is no perfect place. You want to go to Thailand and work with such and such for a year, fine. You got to work and go work in a kitchen and find out what it's like to serve and so on and so forth. Good, good, good. Do it all. Do it all. The 20s, it's different for some people because I've found that, you remember we said in our last conversation that at least in my limited experience, only about 50% of men I know make the ascent to the meadows of the 30s. So you're right, there is something that happens in the 20s, but there are also things that can dull the ache. Dull the ache can be, I really like travel and we're going to travel the rest of our lives. And travel can be intoxicating. I actually know a family that's not too far from here. And about every second or third weekend, they're off to somewhere in the world. I don't know how they afford it, but the fact of the matter is, there's something that in that can dull the senses. There's also a lot of people that just, you get caught up in the work you're doing and you just imagine you'll do it the rest of your life. It's maybe what your father handed you his business. Maybe you went to work in the factory because that's where your parents worked. And, you know, I don't fault anyone for any of those. I grew up in a factory town. And a lot of people I knew, you just went to work in the GM plant. It was 30 and out. And so for you, there were no meadows. There was, if 18, you came out of high school, you could work for General Motors till you were 48, retire with a gold-plated health plan, and get a cottage up north of Michigan, and do a lot of hunting and fishing. There were no meadows. There was 30 years of going to work in what John Mills called the dark satanic mills. I did a couple summers in those factories. I know what it's like. Because you're living for 48. And 48 is a jailbreak. And many of these are the people who feel that the economy and the rest has really screwed them over the last 10, 15 years. And they're resentful of elites and others who seem to be making money on other people's money. And they have no access to all that. So I say that's a whole portion of the population that goes through their 20s. And you really numb some of this. In more of the circles I swing in, is what we joked about. I noticed when I was in my 40s and 50s golfing with these guys, and they're replaying tapes of things they learned in their 20s. They haven't really grown up much, especially in their faith. Why? Because they just did really well financially in their 20s. And they got a lovely home in the burbs. Nothing wrong with that necessarily. They drive a nice BMW. Nothing wrong with that. But those things in and of themselves, if they become possessions, Jesus warned that they just dull your senses, because gods other than God dull your senses. So in the 20s, it really works out very differently, Pat. I don't know why you had this, you began to feel a burr in your saddle and you did something about it, because there's a whole lot of people who will put a Band-Aid over that and just go on. And, it was Thoreau, Thoreau said it well. He said, most men live lives of quiet desperation. Mm.
Well, it's funny, when I walked away from that conversation that I had where I kind of mentioned that, the whole, what ought you to be doing? And I was thinking, man, it sounded pretty cool. I'm glad I came up with that. And then I thought, yeah, but I don't think that gets you any closer to figuring out how to solve the problem.
That's right.
And so that's my question to you is,
okay,
if you're in your 20s, you are feeling a bit restless, like there's something else there. You mentioned following your gut, but I mean, what if you're just not really sure? How do you help guys navigate that?
Okay, very good, very good. And so I'll try to make this as simple as possible, but the language you just used gave away the game. So at least twice you've already said, how do you figure that out?
You gotta feel it out?
Nope.
Oh, I don't know.
Figure out, figure, those that comes from the world of mathematics. Descartes introduced the Cartesian coordinate system. He reduced the world to the mathematics, which is great for flying planes and laying out, doing surveying and what have you, and you could figure things out. Prior to that, there was a notion of discovery, which means to uncover that which is there. And it usually required mentors. And it went with the assumption that there is a God who's made you a certain way, Pat. Calling, you can call it that. And you uncover by going to the next meadow. What is it about Pat Brown that would benefit the world and make him a better version of himself? But the last thing you can do is figure that out. Now, by the way, I hear that all the time. And people that figure things out generally can do really well financially because maybe they figure out how to make a product, how to write code, how to fill the cloud, how to... They are particularly good at what's called efficiency. But they tend to be poor at effectiveness. And effectiveness means it's the difference between doing financially well and having a flourishing life. Now, you could have both. God's preferred condition for everyone is affluence. But affluence is more than just material possessions. And in fact, affluence can have very few material possessions. So the process of discovery for some has been, Pat, going from the 20s to the 30s that I've mentored is deliberating. That is, you can't just all of a sudden now go off and decide you're going to wing it over, take your family over to Oxford and do a PhD. And you, because your family has roots and you have roots and you have to deliberate from every time I want to take a flight here and there, we're just going to go do it. And so the deliberating is, it really is a sense of, okay, I've tried all sorts of things here in my 20s. But now it's time to take a little more seriously who has God made me to be and discover that. And to discover requires subordinating yourself to mentors. And mentors are people who are up in the higher elevations. They're in meadows of their 40s. And 50s. And that tends to be a bit of an un-American feeling for a lot of people. We like to level out life. We believe, C.S. Lewis actually put it well. He goes, the kingdom is not a democracy. So we in America tend to think, we tend to be anti-authoritarian, anti-authority, anti-institution. Democracy means the great leveling. Now, that all people are created equal. I agree, they're all created equal. But Jesus says some have 5 talents, some have 2, some have 1. And frankly, the distribution is none of our business. The deployment is. And so the notion of you in your 20s, you might be wise to put yourself under a mentor for extremely talented people and very strong leaders who are independent-minded. There's just sort of a gut level, no way. It feels constricting. Because I can really figure this thing out. Typically, when you go figure this out, what does that mean? They say, well, look at the business I built. Oh, fascinating.
Do you think it's possible, or I should say, what happens when you try to skip a meadow?
Well, you can't.
Well, the reason I ask, if I would have heard this when I was, I don't know, approaching my 20s or early 20s, I would have heard legacy and immediately thought, I think similar to what you mentioned last week, oh yeah, that's where I'm heading. You know, I want to change the world. and then quickly life humbled me.
yeah.
But I think that's, I don't know. It seems to be the course. You have things to learn first.
I think so. I think that one of the, our listeners might enjoy picking up Neil Postman's book from years ago called Technopoly. The term he coined, Technopoly. He is a combination of technology and monopoly. And his point is that in the past, technologies served us. They were techniques that were actually instrumentalized. And so, you know, you have a hammer and things. Technopoly is when technology dominates your thinking. And by dominating your thinking, it means that, for example, here's a couple of things that I think, because we're in a technopoly, if someone comes along and says, hey, we got our internet's five times as fast, we just went to 5G, and your impulse to go, yeah, we got to get that. But he asked in this question, but in what way does that actually improve your life? How does that make how does that make your life and your family and your time together better? And you see this commercial now, where now Verizon and some others have given you an option. You can turn off the internet over the meal. What does that tell you? It means that we're in a technopoly, that we've become cattle who, unless you put a yoke around us, we don't know where to go. We don't know how to get there. And so in a technopoly, we accelerate some of these things and zip through meadows. So you can come out of Harvard with a group of guys and start a thing called the Facebook. And the next thing you know, you're in your mid-20s and you're now a multimillionaire, billionaire. So you got your legacy already, and now you're going on to da-da-da, and you're learning some of the limits of all this, and you're still not out of your 20s. And because of social technology, I think people can look at that and say, I want to be Zuckerberg. Or that's the way it works. And of course, there's always exceptions, but they generally prove the rule. And the rule is that technology tells us we can accelerate things. We can accelerate plant growth. We can accelerate, through steroids, muscle growth. And we can accelerate maturity and spiritual growth. And I just don't think it works that way. And there may be some exceptional people who have exceptional impacts. That's what the social technology revolution. But remember, it was Coleridge, the poet, who said to Samuel Morse, Morse in his excitement, for some listeners, you have to remind them, Morse code, that was the first of sort of a social technology. And Morse was excited because he said, now Texas can know what Maine is doing. And Coleridge, in effect, asked, but that assumes it's important for Texas to know what Maine is doing. So what technology does, it blinds us to, I know people that travel the globe and are tech savvy, but I think they're pretty, and they'd say they're in touch with everything. I think they're in touch with everything except themselves. And you could spend your entire day on the net and in App City and you can tell with some language using, I don't spend a whole lot of time on all these things, but the fact is you can. And so one of the young men that I helped through the meadows, won't mention his name, lives up in Baltimore. But every time we got together, he gave me 6, 7, 8, for me, seemingly inane facts he had discovered by trolling, by being online all day. And one day I said to him, I said, so what? And he didn't have an answer. To which I said, you know, your challenge is going to be, you could be the life of a cocktail party. If that's what you want to be when you're 40s and 50s, a relational juggernaut. Anybody talks about anything, you say, yeah, you know, I was just reading something in the Utney Reader on that and blah, 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 blah. You will be fascinating for that evening. But you really won't. The impact you will leave on people's lives is similar to the indent left in a bowl of water after you pull your finger out.
There is none.
And that's why the ascent, the 20s can take, you know, myriad. It's a big meadow, so it can be, you can journey all over that frickin' meadow. But the fact of the matter is there's a whole lot of people who find treasure in that meadow, and it's so alluring, they never want to leave. And it gives them what they define as a really good life. A fun life, a full life. And it causes you, by the way, in your 20s, if you're not careful, to forget there's a whole swath of the population that you're living nearby doesn't have access to that good life that you define as a good life. They're stuck, they're trapped in poverty. And so if you're not careful, if you don't climb out of this, literally ascend, but you'll not ascend if you don't sit under a mentor. So we know some young men who are in a faith tradition, very old Christian tradition. And they were, a couple of them were over for dinner a couple weeks ago. They're great guys, by the way. Played basketball with one of them a while back, and many years ago, rather. But they're in a 10-year in their 20s mentoring program. So for the next 2 years, they're in Washington, D.C. working with youth. But they've been in different parts of the world, but all in a mentoring program before they ascend to the 30s and actually are ordained.
Wow, I mean, that's fascinating.
Well, it used to be, if you were going to cobble a horse, you sat under a mentor. If you were going to, it didn't matter what you were going to do, you generally learn by doing under a mentor. Hence, Jesus says to 12, come follow me. But it's difficult.
Oh, yeah. Well, one thing that came to mind I was processing recently was thinking just through, like you talked about, figuring out, thinking about how words and analysis, they're really good in terms of processing what's happened. And so I think in a lot of ways when you're reading, it's almost like you think of a lot of self-help book comes to mind. I think of all of those great management books where you have your favorite word, the principles to live by. And, and when I've resonated well with those books as I'm reading, I'm thinking back and going, oh yeah, I see how I applied that principle here. And I'm recognizing all of these areas past that I connected all these dots, right? I can make sense of that.
Right. But that's
when it comes to the future, I have no idea. It's almost like the bad questions, like, well, what ought you to be doing right now? if only I knew. But I could look back, I'm sure, as you can with the meadows, and go, oh, yeah, I figured out during that time what I ought to be doing, and so I did it. But the reality is we do, we go through these seasons of discovery. It's almost like the mentor model. The thing I like about it, from an educational perspective, is it fits far more into the learning by doing. And I think that's more of, more effective, to your point, in understanding how we move forward.
Yeah. And it is, that's a good point. And it's the mentoring is built, well, it's actually reinforced now by neuroscience. So we like to say the science is catching up to scripture. And Jeremiah, in chapter 17, when he wrote to the exiles in Babylon, he was essentially saying, we are strangers to ourselves. And now findings from neuroimaging indicate you could be no more aware of 5% of your motives and behaviors. The other 95% are non-conscious. Now, non-conscious means you're unaware, but they can be accessed. Unconscious would mean they cannot be accessed. Non-conscious means they can be. So this is an issue of just semantics. It's an issue of substance. Because that 95% of Pat can be uncovered through spiritual guides or spiritual directors. But it's not generally Pat going for a walk in the woods, gazing at his navel, things like that. Now, meditation has great benefit, but generally it's meditation that's coupled with being mentored, because your intuitions can be off. As valuable as they are. Sorry about that, Pat. So the point of coming into your 30s is to have informed or trained intuitions. You never want to stop being intuitive. But I've had a lot of intuitions that were frankly whacked. And they required a mentor. So mentors just see what you don't see. And there's something in especially American sensibilities that go all the way back to René Descartes, the spokesman for the Enlightenment, whether or not we know it. But Descartes, in saying, I think, therefore I am, was saying that you, Pat, can be 100% of your motives and behaviors by thinking. Therefore, you can figure out who you are. You can be 100% conscious. And now we know you can be aware of about 5%. So here, for example, then you can feel, Pat, we can just feel in our bones how, if you're very confident, hitting the ball out of the park in your career and you're in your 20s, this isn't going to make much sense to you. You're going to go, I don't get what you guys are talking about. I'm on top of this stuff. I got this stuff figured out. You really do see this later. You see the social retardation that happens in someone. Like I said, I notice when I go golfing or they're playing paradigms that they learned way back in youth ministry. Or you see it with athletes when the career comes to an end. And many of them are lost in the cosmos. Just, who am I? What am I going to do the rest of my life? And it's stuff you didn't have to worry about, because especially now, say you're a great high school player, and the next thing you know, you are in this this hole. You're just sucked into this jet stream of social media. And when you announce what college you're going to, it's worldwide. Pat, can you imagine what it's like to be 17, 18 years old? And everybody, and you have millions of people watching you on the internet to tell everyone you're going to Maryland.
Oh, yeah.
Can you imagine what it'd be like?
Unbelievable. I mean,
they couldn't have made a helmet big enough for my head. I really don't know how they do it. I was interviewed after the first college game I played in. And I, to this day, I think it was just I had no idea.
I hope that's on YouTube somewhere.
No, it isn't. Fortunately, I took off my leather helmet and they were. And then let's just say you do well enough that you're drafted. And again, you've got, not only do you have, you know, everyone around the world has access to this, but second, you're all of a sudden, you have a big bullseye, you're a millionaire. There's a family across the bay on the eastern shore of Maryland. This is now 20 years ago. They won one of the many lotteries. I don't even know how much money it was. Let's say it was a couple hundred thousand. They obviously, this was back in the landlines, eventually had to switch addresses, switch phone. They received 77,000 pieces of hard mail in the first year.
Oh, I don't doubt it. You know, it's funny. I've thought about celebrities. You know, I think we grow up, unfortunately, the American dream has kind of been skewed to this notion of I have so much wealth and influence that I can do whatever I want, whether we look at celebrities or wealthy leaders of companies. And, you know, I think it's funny. Obviously, the Lord's Prayer, we're asked to get our daily bread. Give us our daily bread. And just in processing through a lot of that, I started to wake up and realize, you know, I have a lot of freedom to be able to leave my house and really go to whatever restaurant I want. And I can order my meal, have dinner, enjoy time with my wife, and go home. I don't know many celebrities who are world famous that can do that without an entourage of people and others trying to take their photograph. And so it was just sort of awakening to this fallacy of that. I don't think that's the American dream. I think there's something off there. To your point, we want that stage and we don't realize how limiting that actually is. I'm so thankful. I mean, it's incredible how much freedom I have as really a nobody when it comes to the world
that's
scale.
That's right. Bingo.
It's great. But it is. I think it points back to, we're told to ask for our daily bread, not more, not less. That's fascinating.
Well, you might remember that it is. And you just hit the nail on the head. It was Michael Jordan, when he retired the first time from the NBA, he said it was because he had never been to the mall with his children.
Mm.
And so... If an NBA team rents an entire floor of a hotel with security, and so you have some exceptions with some players, some are taking online courses and the rest, but literally you don't leave your hotel room because everywhere you go, you're not going to be able to get there.
Yeah.
Without, and can you imagine what that's like? I have friends in Louisville, and they were saying this was very early in his career, but Tiger Woods used to have a team. I guess maybe just one or two persons, but they went ahead and they bought a home. This was in Valhalla, outside of Louisville. And so they would furnish the home. Tiger came and stayed for the 5 days, the day before, caterers, but he could stay in a home and be and have some privacy, and then they put the home on the market when he left.
Wow!
Imagine that kind of a life. That, but not picking on any of these people, we do the same thing. So that's again, we're getting back to the difficulty of ascending these meadows, is we all insulate our lives to some degree, yeah. And it's not a coincidence that Jesus picks out one thing that seemingly insulates us more than anything else, and he called it mammon. And mammon is the Babylonian term that denotes confidence. It's money, but it denotes confidence. And I darn well know the feeling of, say, I have check comes in the mail, run to the bank, cash it. Say it's $100, $20, $520, stuff in my wallet. There's just something when I slide that wall in the back of my pants that I think, yeah, life just got a little better. And it did in some regards. But that's something that I don't think Americans, by and large, and this includes the faith community, have come to terms with. That Jesus really meant what he said there. He really meant it. That money has often insulated me. And some of those insulations, they're fine. But if you're too insulated in your 20s, that's why I said climb a mountain in Tibet, go here, go there. I went to one of the poorest islands in the world in Micronesia in my 20s. And it was part of a mission group. But I stayed in a hotel that I called Berlin 1945 after the shooting had stopped. It was hellish. But this island is actually an atoll. And as an atoll, it's 1 foot above sea level. And when we landed on our little Continental Jet 727, skid to a halt on the crushed shell runway, first thing you see are containers, some container ships strewn all over the place, on the beach, in the little bit of jungle. And like I say, a little bit of jungle, think of it just in big, like a crescent of the moon. This was like a couple miles long, but it's just one big, long, or curving crescent, no more than a couple hundred yards wide. And there's hundreds of people who live there. And it trash everywhere. And they are trapped in this poverty. But the island is hellishly polluted with trash. But it was good for me to go to those kind of places. Not that you make much of a dent there, but it makes a huge dent in you. When you come home, you land at LAX. And you go, oh my goodness. And then you try to communicate this to your friends, and some of them think you're a Martian. And you realize, unless you get away from some of your insulations, all these things that Jesus talked about, you're just not going to take them seriously. And if you don't take them seriously, then by and large, you're going to fabricate what you think is a flourishing life and bend the Bible to your will. And the notion of ascending, because there are some unique things that you can do for the flourishing of all 30s, 40s. There is something, like you said it well, that you want to make a mark that goes beyond you for the good of all. And then especially 50s, limits. And limits are a sobriety check that you go, gosh, Mike Metzger is never going to do all the things he really thought he was going to do. And that's A-okay. 50s are the second great epochs when couples get divorced. And it is often, as I've tragically seen in the last couple of years, men they're going to try to relive their 20s because they never had a whole lot of fun. They worked their butt off, did well financially, built the company, blah, 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 blah. And now in their estimation, as some have said, their wife's worn out. She's not interested in sex. The kids have left, and they're going to go back and relive their 20s, dump the wife, find a young babe who's looking for financial security, and I ain't making this up. And so these meadows are critical for people who feel that life is a gift that we are to steward.
I'm very curious. You've talked about the meadows being sort of like a pattern. You've noticed this. You've noticed it happens to be in 10 years. It almost is, is almost like a hint there that life just kind of is this way. These meadows exist. I'm curious, have you made a connection to why? Like, what does the existence of these meadows tell us about either God, or how does it link back to the four chapter gospel? And what's the connection there? Have you made that?
Not particularly well. It's a really good question. There is, you and I have joked before. In fact, you sent me a little snippet of a book where you said, once again, science catching up to scripture.
Hmm.
And there is a lot of benefit, I think, in some of the more recent findings in neuroscience about how long it takes for something to become a habit. And there might be some correlation there, Pat, that the 20s, I think you should cultivate a habit that you have explored, and you are a curious person, and nurture is not the right word, but you've stimulated that curiosity. I mean, there are frankly some people I know in their 30s already, they're boring. They're already boring. And they're just, so if you say, man, read this. Here, I gave you a one-page summary of this. This is a fascinating article. You see them a week later. Hey, did you read it? Nah, I didn't have time to get to that. BS. We make time for what's important. And what they're telling you is that we ended up watching a couple of shows on Netflix. I'm not opposed to Netflix. But, you choose where you spend your time. And entertainment, it comes from the French to hold. If you entertain a thought, you hold it. But it works both ways. Entertainment can hold you. And what it does over time, if you're not careful, is it dulls your senses, particularly your curiosity. And I find not many men my age or women are particularly curious about the world anymore. If I want to play pickleball. But not that there's anything wrong with pickleball, by the way. We don't want to get irate listeners. But they're not really curious about the world around them. And I think the 20s, because it's this burn the candle at both ends, it's to discover curiosity might have killed the cat, but it didn't have to. And it doesn't have to kill you. A lack of curiosity kills you. And it's the curiosity for me, part of it is, especially in this Advent season, is to read in the lectionary readings and just... it's just fascinating what older traditions, how they pull together some Old Testament poetry and history and prophets and then New Testament gospel and epistles. And recently we've been in Amos. And it's just so much, it's just fascinating to have. You had one time, it was Amaziah, I believe, and Amos was warning that Israel is going to be heading into exile. We know today it was Assyria. And Amaziah tells the king, hey, we got a guy over here is telling us things aren't going to go very well. And he finally says to Amos, why don't you go tell the Judeans about this? This is, we're God's kingdom. And I love it. It's just, it's like you come out of church and someone says, man, that was a fantastic sermon. That'd be great for Pat to hear. He's got to laugh and you go, why do we act this way? And I went to college to be a psychology major. It didn't end up there, but it was because I was really pushed along by this. Why do we act this way? And the older I get, the more and more I see that scripture tells us, and the neuroscience is supporting it, but I find very few Christians who are that curious. What they're really curious is, give me the three-point outline from this part of it. Okay, good. Okay, now here's Romans 7. Here's three-point outline. Good, isn't that? I'll tell you a funny joke, Pat, because we have time. So I went to, I won't tell you the cemetery I went to. I'm sorry, did I say cemetery? we had chapel 4 days a week. And this seminary has been around since 19, it doesn't matter. But the president at that time had been there a long time. Wonderful man. But he would sit behind the speaker. It was a chapel. There was a couple hundred of us in there. Maybe it was 1,000. And during my first year, which, to be honest, I used to sit there in chapel because it was mandatory, and I would memorize my Greek vocabulary. I had little flashcards in my lap. But I would listen to these speakers. So someone stood up and say, today I'm going to preach from Romans 7. And I was thinking, the president's going, okay, I heard this. I heard this passage 1953, 1957, 1962, 1975, 1981. I said, no wonder he looks bored out of his mind. Because I'll wager he didn't learn anything, discover rather, anything deeper, higher, wider than he had heard for 40 years as president. I mean, I hope they were paying him a lot, because he almost had to feign interest. But even as students, we had to feign interest because, okay, here's the three-point thing. It's the explanation of the law, and then the living out of the law, and everything had to be 3 points. And I would just go, my gosh, I know we believe in a triune God, we're a Trinitarian faith, but does that mean God, everything he said was in 3-point outlines? So you don't get the sense you discover anything new, where you just go, whoa, whoa, wow, let's go deeper into that mystery. Let's go deeper into that mystery. Louise Cowan put it well. She said, faith is a certain widening of the imagination. So even though Mary was a faithful servant of the Lord, when the angel appears and says, you are going to have a child, she who was a virgin, he asked, how can this be? That wasn't a rejection. It was asking the angel to widen her imagination. And he does. Holy Spirit shall come upon you. And her response, so be it. So I've never thought about this before, Pat, but part of why you ascend the meadows is it widens the vistas for your faith. He and I both done some climbing of mountains. We're not mountain climbers per se, but I've been to Long's Peak in Colorado, and you're up there at 14,000 feet. Your vista is really widened. People who have had their vistas widened are fascinated by the Lord, fascinated by life, and fascinating to be with, at least in my experience. And they're just, I'm 65. There aren't a lot of guys 65 years old who are fascinating to be with. We just go, I mean, I can count a few of them where they might hand me a book or a link or this and go, listen, this is pretty fascinating when we think about being the bride of Christ. Look at what this person's saying here. There's a good little magazine online called Aeon. And one of their writers once talked about, well, if there's a three-dimensional world, then logically you can get to a fourth and a fifth and a sixth. And then they went on to say there could be infinite dimensions to reality. And you're sitting there going, oh my stars, this is very similar to the language of Paul in 1 Corinthians. You go, oh my goodness, this is, oh.
I think curiosity, the teachers that were most effective in my life were teachers mm-hmm. that clearly loved their subject, but also instilled that sense of curiosity, that wonder mm-hmm. in how things work. I think of math and how boring it can be for some. But when you actually start to understand some physics and some, you start to see how math is just everywhere in the universe. Yeah. It even starts to tell a story, particularly for believers, of how God created things to be. I mean, it is incredible. If you never discover that, your time in high school and college, it can just be a waste. You miss the wow. And that is something I have to guess does not change, like you said, through the meadows. It's just different. The wow in your 20s is so many things far and wide. The wow in your 30s, what I'm beginning to feel mm-hmm. is that the wow is not as, it's not as far, it's not as wide necessarily as it used to be. It's just deeper. I'm mm-hmm. going deeper in my focused areas. But it's that wow that, yeah, if you miss it, it's hard to get that back.
Exactly. And that's why the distinction when you go to the next meadows, math is inherently good, but we live in a world of what's called mathematization. Gosh, who writes these big old words?
They just make them up.
So mathematization is a reducing of everything in life to math. So in other words, if you can make a killing by writing code and really become multimillionaire, I mean, that's it. You nailed it, man. You know code. And code is important. It's math. But what you're not dazzled, and so if you're dazzled by that, then you're not dazzled by this. The Fibonacci sequence is also math. So listeners, if you've never heard of that, Google it. Fibonacci is a mathematical equation that's over 1,000 instances in the world. The pattern of hurricanes, the pattern in your face, the pattern in your fingernails, the pattern in plants, the pattern in pine cones is a mathematically exact expansion that's seen of over 1,000 ways in the natural world. And get this, I don't know how, I'm not, but you read about it and they say, and the number becomes, that sequence becomes more and more exacting the further out it goes, but it looks like it's infinite. Oh my goodness. So Pat, if you can imagine Fibonacci and say the pattern of hurricanes, you see that expanding wheel going out and out. That's actually mathematically exact. But here's the gospel. God is love. Love is the enjoyment of the circle, Father, Son, Spirit, and the desire to expand the circle by creating a bride for the Son. Love is enjoyment and expansion. And that expansion will be infinite. And if you look around the natural world, you have over 1,000 instances of infinite mathematical expansion. Why did God create that? If you're in your 20s, burn the candle at both ends. But if you want to get in a place in your life when you're 65, that you still are wowed by that and drawn to make the most of your life, then don't stay stuck in your 20s where you'll hear something like this and you'll go, oh, that's neat. Make the ascent. Find a mentor. Call me if you want. We'll see what we can pull together. Make the ascent. You get towards the end of your 30s. Make the ascent under the guidance of a mentor to discover, so how do you craft this into a legacy for the good of as many people as possible? This wasn't just for your private gain, your private business, and your private good. Because once you get to your 50s, find a mentor to help you make the ascent into limits. Because in limits, you learn contentment. And Paul said, godliness is of great benefit when coupled with contentment. And contentment might mean that you give it all away. Paul said, I've learned to be content in much and in little. And then find a mentor to help you get into your 60s meadow to make a strategic allocation of whatever resources that you have carefully cultivated, because some of your friends, the numbers will begin to increase with some of your friends who will pass from this earth. You might go into your 90s, 100, but you'll begin to say goodbye to some friends. And so you have to think strategic allocation. Make the ascent.